Today's guest is a musician, storyteller, and humanitarian whose work has resonated across the world. We're joined by Grammy-nominated John Ondrasik, the voice behind Five for Fighting, known for heartfelt hits like Superman and 100 Years. His music has become a soundtrack for moments of reflection, resilience, and hope. Beyond the stage, John is deeply committed to using his platform for good, from advocating for freedom to supporting music education through Let Music Fill My World, a nonprofit dedicated to giving every child access to the power of music. Music can provide purpose and both heal and inspire action. We hope you enjoy our conversation and the informative and emotional ride it takes us on. Let's get into it. John, welcome to Hear Us Out.
Nice to be with you. Hey, Eric. Hey, Michelle.
I was introduced to your music post 9/11 when Superman became an anthem during a time of national grief. What did that level of personal and professional success feel like during such a heavy cultural moment?
That's a big question. And, you know, and I could say I've been trying to answer it for, 24 years. Certainly as a musician and aspiring songwriter, to be on a stage with all of your living icons is beyond imagination. But of course, the reason we were there kind of dismissed all that. And the fact that Superman became a song that recognized the heroes of 9/11 and gave a certain solace to families that lost loved ones in 9/11, and frankly, the country. I think that's hard for anybody to absorb. And of course, you're horrified by the event, but you're grateful that there are songs like that. And there's nothing like music that can provide that kind of solace. And I think that kind of mass kind of mourning with maybe a ray of hope at the end. What really kind of transformed me at that moment, it wasn't necessarily me. I remember watching The Who blow the roof off Madison Square Garden that night. And I looked out in the audience and there were people singing and crying and holding each other. And most of the folks at that concert had been down at Ground Zero, kind of digging through the rubble of the unimaginable. And I think for many of them, it was the first time they could release. And I remember when I was singing Superman, I kind of just focused on this one kind of big union worker in the crowd. And he had a beer in each hand and probably weighed, 250 pounds, kind of tough dude. And he was singing Superman and tears were just running down his face. And so I think that experience for me really had kind of a brain switch of like, okay, this is why music matters. It's nice to have hits. It's nice to have fame and fortune, celebrity. But every once in a while, music can transcend. And certainly that night it did for all of the artists and America and frankly the world.
Absolutely.
Actually right on that border where I'm a little bit young for remembering 9/11, but was alive for it. And even I've heard of your performance and how your song has been this anthem. Has it been internalized for you that you've been able to reach and touch people who have not experienced 9/11 themselves or remember the effects of it, but have still been able to kind of educate us about it?
Yeah, every time 9/11 rolls around, you'll hear Superman. You'll actually hear a song called Tuesday. That's a song I wrote kind of about my experience playing the concert for New York. And yes, it certainly has a different tone. But, the song has had so many lives and it affected so many people and so many causes. The best thing about having popular songs is that you can use them to shine the spotlight on causes or people that are important to you. Superman was a big song for the autism community. I remember, and you guys, again, is kind of really fits your show. I remember walking off stage one day and there is a family with a very autistic child, a boy probably 9 years old, could not interact at all, kind of was running to the corner, all the struggles that families with autistic kids have. And the mother kept saying, hey, here's the Superman guy. And as soon as she said that, literally he kind of froze and he walked right up to me like 6 inches from my face. And together we sang Superman. And that just, again, it was an education to me of the power of music for whether it's therapy or connecting. And so, those events to me, throughout my career, and they still happen. Just in the last month, we've done a new version of Superman for one of the hostages, Alone OL. And that song, it's got 30 million impressions. So the fact that that song can still continue to, in my mind, shine the light on people who are true heroes or people in true need, that's what I'm grateful for. You know, I pinch myself when I hear the song on the radio still, you know, any song of mine, you know, it's still like, how did this ever happen? You know, it was a total fluke. But the nice thing about 100 Years and Superman and The Riddle and World is that they continue to have impact in the culture. And I think as a songwriter, it's great to have a hit song. But to have songs that stand the test of time, like all of my idols that were on that stage, the concert for, you know, that's something I'm really grateful for. And it's not just me. It's, you know, dozens of people who supported me throughout my career. Most importantly, my wife. So it all goes back to the wife. But so that's a long answer to your question, Michelle.
So you just mentioned the reworking of Superman for The Hostage Alone. Can you talk about the experiences of playing that song in Israel and Tel Aviv and playing also in New York, where your music becomes a soundtrack for these big emotional moments? You're in the middle of that. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I know. You know, I never thought I'd have an experience close to the concert for New York. But here we are, you know, 24 years later, playing Superman and another song I wrote called OK, We're Not OK in Tel Aviv at Hostage Square for, you know, thousands of Israelis in the world. And more importantly, you know, hundreds of hostage families who are standing 10 feet from me holding the poster of their face of their loved one. That again brought me right back to the concert for New York of people who are really suffering kind of the unimaginable. But how music can, I don't know what the word is, whether it's solace or hope or just a fact that somebody cares about their plight, whatever it is, I think the nice thing about music is people take it and apply it to themselves the way they need it. And one thing that kind of made me aware of that, talking about big events, during the first Iraq war, I would correspond with many of our soldiers who would use music as therapy, you know, but the interesting thing is they'd use like the same song for many different applications. Some would say, oh, I use it to calm down after a mission. I use it to pump myself up after a mission. I use it to just forget about everything and escape. And so the unique thing about music is we take it in and we apply it to our lives in a way maybe the songwriter never intended. When people say, what did that song? I just got an email the other day about a kind of an obscure song. Said, here's what this song means to me. But what did it mean when you wrote it? And I said, it meant what you're feeling. I don't want to take away that impression. And I think that's, again, the unique thing about music and why it can be applied in so many different ways and in so many different therapeutic ways. And I'm very encouraged to see music therapy being employed more, especially for children in so many hospitals and medical situations where sometimes music can have the same power and effect as drugs. Sometimes you need drugs. I take Celexa. I need it when I need it, you know, but sometimes you can get the same results from music therapy without having to use as much medication. So again, a long answer to your question, but yeah, it's heavy being in the middle of these things. You know, I wrote a song about Afghanistan. I went to Ukraine. But again, I think of the people on the other side of the song, you know, Gold Star family members, you know, hostage family members. And it gives me energy to understand that, you know, I'm the lucky one. I'm you know, we're all the lucky ones. And if you have an ability to help folks in need, whether you're a musician or doctors, podcasters, I think I feel an obligation to do that. And I'll imagine I'll keep doing that.
I think I heard you say in an interview somewhere, please correct me if I'm wrong, I'm definitely paraphrasing, but that you've become more comfortable over time speaking about issues that you're passionate about. What led for you in that shift of being more comfortable to be more vocal?
Yeah, well, I think part of that's age. You know, been doing this a long time. Part of it's the reality that, you know, I'm 60 years old on the backside of my career and the consequences for me are, you know, at least in the music space, you know, are pretty trivial. I mean, yeah, somebody won't play my song or license a song or buy a ticket. But I also, you know, I've always kind of spoke kind of my beliefs through my songs in a way that was not standing on a soapbox and lecturing. Because I get very annoyed with celebrities who stand on a soapbox and lecture us about their political views. But on the other side, you know, music has a history of writing about the times And music, basically, if you listen to the music of the 60s, you get a sense of the times that you don't from reading a book or watching a documentary. So artists have already always spoke about the times they live in. Now, I would write songs about our troops. I would write a song about our military families. I'd write a song, What Kind of World Do You Want? But I think what really kind of triggered this kind of last couple of years is the Afghanistan withdrawal, when I had little friends going down to Afghanistan.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Afghanistan to rescue people we abandoned, and the fact that military leaders were basically lying to us. I have such great respect for our troops. I always thought, you know, politicians will do crazy things, they'll say anything. But when Mark Milley and General Austin started parroting the, what an extraordinary success, that scared me. And I think that pushed me over the edge. And I didn't plan on doing any more after that one, but, you know, events happen and you write songs about them. But for whatever reason, I'm in this space. And I think the other reason, Michelle, that people ask that question is because so few other artists are doing it. I think it's been really a historic disgrace to see the silence of the music industry. We've been talking a lot about those icons that were on that stage condemning Osama bin Laden in 2001. Where are they now after October 7th? They can't even say free the hostages. So I think we have a moral crisis in the arts, the toxicity of the unwillingness to say basic, simple moral truths. With Afghanistan, abandoning your citizens and allies to the Taliban is a bad thing. Putin, he's a bad guy. Hamas, if you can't say free the hostages, you have a problem, a deep problem. And I think that's where we are right now. And it's something that really, I don't know what the right word, I feel ashamed. I feel ashamed of my own industry. But at the same time, we all do what we do, and perhaps others will be shamed or inspired to do things that I believe are the right things. Again, I think music is always a reflection of the culture. And I think right now we're seeing a broken culture, but perhaps that can improve as we kind of realize that.
Have you felt any sense of backlash? I know you had mentioned that maybe somebody doesn't come to a show, maybe the song is not getting played in a rotation. Have you felt any personal backlash to being more vocal, or has it just been something that you are speaking with your moral clarity out into the world, and so be it?
Well, you know, we live in an internet age, and especially, you know, you get kind of some media backlash. And of course, you get the vitriol online. I've said this before, but again, I'm not Jewish. But after I released my song, Okay, We're Not Okay, I got a very small sense of what it's like to be Jewish. The vitriol, the threats. And look, I have to hire extra security when I go on tour. It's the real world. Yes, I get a lot of, you know, hatred and backlash. But I also get a lot of, like, thank you for speaking up when nobody's doing it. So I think I understand that if nobody hates you or is angry at you, you're probably not doing anything. And I also see the fickleness of the media, you know, who disdained, the music media disdained my Afghanistan song because it was critical of their party. They loved my Ukraine song. And then they again kind of, there was kind of a mixed reaction to the Israel stuff, but mostly, you know, disdain from the arts. So you're never going to please everybody. But I think that's what's, you know, that was, again, it's a hyperbole, but that's what makes America and the West great. We all have our views. We put them out there. We can argue about them and we can kind of have that discussion. But unfortunately, especially with Israel, you know, the vitriol, and I think the kind of cultist kind of radical attitude of many that are free Palestine, that makes it a little more dangerous. I mean, we saw that happen in D.C. a couple of weeks ago when two innocents were just murdered for being there. I'm afraid that will not be the last one of those we see. But the more of us that speak out, I think, with conscience and with humility and with compassion for all sides, makes each of us safer. So that's the way I look at it.
Do you feel like I'm going to call it celebrities or musicians, anybody who has a platform has a responsibility to speak out on these kind of issues? Or do you think it really should be just a personal choice? Because most artists, as you said, tend to stay silent.
It's a good question. You know, in the past, you know, if you would ask me this 2 years ago, I'd say, of course, it's a choice. You don't have to pick a side. Sometimes, you know, people just want to sing a song, and most people just want a song sung to them. So I understand that. And my tendency would say, you know, it's a choice. You don't have to speak out on every issue. What's happened since October 7th, though, is different. A lot of people, you know, including me, have always wondered, how could the Holocaust ever happen? How could that happen? That's impossible. That could never happen today. Well, we see how it could happen. Because when the silence of good people echo, are the loudest, then you seed the narrative to the radicals, in my mind. So I believe, you know, the ending of my video, the OK video, was Martin Luther King's quote, silence in the face of evil is complicity. So I think you have certain events in life, in history, that if you don't speak out, that says something. You don't need to speak out about abortion. You don't need to speak out about, if you don't want to, if you don't need to speak out about the big, beautiful bill or whatever the issue of the day is. But when it's these huge issues, I think, of moral clarity, if you're not speaking and you have a history of being the human rights advocate, I think that says something. If you're a new artist and you're 22 and you're making your first record and you don't really know and you don't want to speak out, I don't have a problem with you at all. I respect that. And if you're struggling to come up, I understand you don't want to say anything. But if you're Bruce Springsteen, if you're Bono, if you're Barbara Streisand, if you're John Mellencamp, if you're all these people, if you're, you know, all these celebrities who like to lecture us about human rights, if all of a sudden you're silent now, I think that is unacceptable. And I do think those people are failing, morally failing. But again, you know, if I was 25 years old, you know, trying to make my new record, would I be saying this stuff right now? I don't know. I got to be honest. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a big step to be taking with a big voice in this world that is not so forgiving if people don't agree with the perspective that you're sharing. I wanted to go back to, you were talking about our troops and how you've done work to the benefit of the troops. We see a lot of veterans through the VA for hearing testing because hearing loss and tinnitus are the most common disabilities from our recent wars. So they're absolutely inundated. And one of the things that is required of us in those appointments is to say to the veteran, thank you for your service. And we had a Air Force pilot on the podcast, and I asked him, what do you think of that statement? How does that land with the veteran who's hearing it? And he gave an interesting answer of not really being affected by that and just kind of moving through that statement. How do you feel the work you do with veterans and for their benefit? How are you received by those kind of out there doing that incredibly difficult, life-threatening work?
You know, I think most people appreciate it. Again, I understand when you hear that every few minutes, but I also know there are many soldiers who deeply appreciate that, but typically the older ones, typically our veterans.
And they weren't so supported.
Yeah, who understand that. You know, I would have to like point to my pal, Gary Sinise, you know, who is kind of our modern day Bob Hope. And we do a lot of work together and we do concerts together. You know, he has his own band. He's a bass player. And spending time with him, I do see the deep gratitude of our troops and military families. And when I mention his name at a concert, you know, there's always at least 20, 30 people who kind of scream or clap. So I do think, you know, especially people forget, I actually did a project 15 years ago called the CD for the Troops during the Iraq wars. And one reason I did it was because so many troops, you know, felt in a way abandoned or attacked by the arts because, you know, you had a lot of these anti-military groups or, you know, peace groups. And even though they may not have been attacking our troops, the troops felt that they were under attack, you know? And so we did this project and I got, you know, it was funny. Nobody wanted to do it, but the first person who gave me a song was Melissa Etheridge, actually, gave me her biggest song, Come to My Window. And Melissa is very liberal, very kind of on the left, but she understood this is not a political statement. This is like, we're supporting our troops who are fighting and dying for us right now and fighting for freedom. And that became a really big thing. And then we got all the big Billy Joel and Josh Groban, blah, blah, blah. And we did, you know, millions of those. So again, I think our troops in certain times really need to understand that we got their back. And it happened with Afghanistan. Our Afghan veterans felt gutted by the fact that we abandoned their allies, that some of them saved their lives. So I think at times our troops really need to hear it. You know, whenever I'm on a plane or I'm somewhere and there's somebody, I'll buy their lunch or I'll say thank you. And I'll do the same for firefighters and police officers. So I think it depends on the person. I think some really appreciate it. I do know this. I know our military families really appreciate it. Because sometimes they're the ones that kind of, they don't hear it every day. So when you kind of, you know, recognize the families of our troops as well as our soldiers, I think that goes a long way. But yeah, you know, everybody's an individual and I'll still be saying thanks for your service. And, you know, they take it in. A lot of it's for us too, right? A lot of it's for our own kind of, I think it makes us feel good when we thank people for anything, you know, when you thank our doctors, you know, when we thank our teachers, I think it makes us feel good too. So
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Part of it saying thank you for your service is as much for us as it is for them.
I know you actually give free tickets to your shows for veterans. How do you choose which causes you tend to support, what causes, what organizations you are passionate to support?
Yeah, that's a good question too. Typically, they just kind of, you know, I get approached a lot about many different organizations and they're all worthwhile. Our troops has always been kind of my main passion from day one when I started my career, whether it was, you know, going on USO tours or writing songs or going to USO hospital, you know, going to hospitals, VA hospitals. But along the way, you know, you get approached by people that inspire you. I did a lot of work with ALS because a guy named Augie Nieto wanted me to play 100 years at his fundraiser. And he had ALS and he was kind of fighting the fight and he raised millions, hundreds of millions of dollars to fight. And just being in contact with him and his family, I quickly became a soldier in his army just because he became a mentor for me. And so that kind of, I just kind of fell into that. The autism work, you know, early after Superman became because my project manager had an autistic child, you know, so you kind of just find, you know, the Israel stuff just kind of came out of October 7th. Again, I'm not Jewish. Of course, I have Jewish friends, but it became something passionate to me and the Afghanistan thing too. So I think whatever kind of just, you know, hits my nerve is what I end up finding myself working in. But of course, I have a lot of things outside of music in my life, you know? So there's a, you know, we have a family business. I'm a dad, you know, I'm a husband, I'm a son, you know, I like to do things that are fun too, you know? So I think we try to incorporate it all in our lives. There's never enough time for it all, but you do have to kind of pick and choose because you don't, if you do something, you want to make sure you can give, you know, give enough yourself to make a difference.
You know, having just recently lost a close family member to ALS, I appreciate you supporting those organizations because they do amazing things for the families dealing with impossible situations. And the needs in those situations are, I would say, unless you're in it, it's kind of unimaginable. Like you don't even think of the complications that can arise for people in the most simple of day-to-day activities. So I appreciate all of the charitable work you do. I really appreciate hearing you kind of raising awareness on that front because so many people are just not aware of that disease and the effects it has.
No, you're right. And my condolences. And yeah, I mean, as you know, as doctors, you know, ALS is an orphan disease. You know, there's not enough people who get it to spend tens of billions of dollars. But Augie was different in that, you know, he founded Life Fitness. He had a lot of resources. He basically founded his own hospital and hired his own doctors. And they've made progress that will affect not just ALS, but MS, all the kind of muscular diseases. So, and you're right, people, unless you know someone with ALS, you don't understand the struggle, the need for the chair and the computer and the communication, because most people with ALS, you know, eventually give up because they can't communicate, they can't move. But, you know, Augie's mind to the end, he actually lived 15 years with ALS, which is a miracle.
Wow.
They built him a robot so he could walk his daughter down the aisle, you know.
My gosh.
And I think part of the reason he lived so long was he had purpose. Mm-hmm. He was on, you know, he couldn't talk. He could only write with his toe, and he was on seven, you know, billion-dollar boards across America. So I think giving people purpose and also giving the families what they need, because if you talk, you know, from the outside, certainly it's, I wouldn't wish ALS on my worst enemy, but the trauma to the families, as you know, is so hard. Mm-hmm. And expense of the full-time nurses and all that that goes into us. It's not just the victim, it's the families are all victim. And so I'm with you 100%, you know, that, and that's why I kind of actually picked some of these smaller things. Mm-hmm. I used to do the Jerry Lewis telethon every year and all that stuff. And they would say, do this. I'm like, you don't need me. You have the whole world. Right. But like the ALS and frankly, Israel and the Jewish people have been abandoned by much of the world. So to me, it makes it, I don't say easier, but it makes me maybe a little more interested in supporting them because they don't have, you know, $1 billion fund, and they don't have every celebrity doing their cause, and they don't have every athlete, you know, it's not breast cancer. You know, I don't need to do breast cancer. We all wear pink with breast cancer month. It's amazing. You know, breast cancer is in good spot, but some of these other things, I think for me, I feel I have a bit more impact.
That was going to be my next question.
You said you're a dad. How has it been having your kids watch you through your career, how they've seen you evolve over time, both in your music, in your outreach? How has that been for you to know that they've been watching you through that?
Another good question. Again, I think, first of all, you're kind of just dad for the most part. They're not very impressed. You know, it's like, I think my dog is more impressed sometimes when I come home than my kids. You know, you know, they go to my concerts. They've seen me 1,000 times. My daughter is an aspiring musician. So I think she's kind of takes a little bit more from what I do. But I think, you know, hopefully as a parent, what you want to do is just kind of show kids values. You know, they may have no interest in music, but they see you working hard and they see you supporting people who are really good people in need. And I think especially now my kids are in their 20s, they have a little more appreciation for some of the stuff I'm doing. And they frankly joined in. My son, Johnny, went with me to Israel. It made my wife very upset, especially when we were there, when Iran bombed. But you know, so my son participates in that. And my daughter is now opening for me on the road. So again, we didn't push them into these things. It's their decisions. But of course, you know, when your kids say, hey, I'm proud of you, dad, you know, there's nothing better. And I'm equally proud of them as they kind of find their way. So, and you can't do this stuff without the support of your family. You just can't. And it's not just my wife and my kids, it's my parents who've been incredibly supportive throughout my whole career. Without them, I would not have this career. So I think I say, you know, whatever good works I do, you can look at my parents, my wife, and my kids. They're my inspiration every day.
You know, we hear from a lot of the musicians that we know, they'll talk about how lucky they are to get to do what they do. They got to follow their dream. And in the context of that, there's always a little but. And whether it's the grind of touring or whatever else you might be encountering on the road, for you, what is challenging within the grind of a career that takes you away from home and takes you away from family and has you on a bus or in a tour van for months on end?
That's another great question. No, I talk to athletes about this all the time. And the thing we laugh about when people, you know, come and say, it must be so much fun. And it's many things, but it's not fun. You can have fun times. It's satisfying, it's exhilarating, it's exhausting, but, you know, success can bring its own challenges. I think especially for, and I always kind of look at celebrities, I think of musicians and athletes. especially if it comes at a very young age. Because to do this, you have to have a certain sense of narcissism. And that can bring problems when you have success at a young age. You know, people always say your maturity stops when you have success, you know, the Elvis thing. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. I was lucky, I think, that my success came relatively late. I was in my late 20s. And I'd struggled for 15 years. And I understood there was a lot of other folks responsible for my success. And even with that, I struggled, I think, with celebrity and all the stuff that comes with it. And you need an ego, but you need to be able to turn it off when you walk off stage. So for me, I think I understand that. You're certainly grateful for what you do. But yeah, I mean, I was laughing on we just got off the road last week. And, you know, I'm literally driving the Sprinter now, you know, 500 miles across West Virginia. I kind of like it. And then I have all this, you know, activism stuff, and then I have the family business. To me, the easiest part of the day is the hour and a half on stage. That's the part you can relax and you don't think about everything. So it sounds, again, it sounds kind of ungrateful when you say, yeah, it's a grind. But when your kids are 4 and 5, but you have to do 200 shows a year, there's a cost for that. There's a cost for that. And it took me a long time to understand that. I talk about this in my keynotes. You know, I call it the great challenge. And, you know, everybody talks about how do you balance your life, right? But I think particularly for artists and stuff, you know, I never said the word no for 20 years because I was afraid that if I said no and I didn't go do that promotion, the whole thing would collapse. And it really took an awakening for me to say, okay, I'm going to sacrifice some potential things on my career to have a better wellness in my family life, in my personal life. Your personal life for an artist is always the hardest because, you know, you're always thinking of everybody else and I got to performing for people or I have to do this for that. And a lot of times I think we forget we got to take care of ourselves first. I'll tell you one little last story about Superman that I think, you know, we've been talking about Superman a lot. When Superman became a big song, the record company came to me and said, something very strange is happening with your song. Old people are buying your song. And I'm like,
wait, what was old?
Well, that's what I said. I said, what's old? Okay. They said, yeah, people in their 30s and 40s are buying your song. And I was like, kind of offended actually. But what they meant was kids were not buying Superman. You know, basically teenagers buy music, consume music, not adults. And I think I've understood in the last 20 some years why, because in my Superman song, as opposed to all the other Superman songs, and there's a lot of them, in my song, Superman doesn't want to be Superman. What's the first lyric? I can't stand to fly. Who wouldn't want to fly? But in my song, Superman doesn't want to be Superman because he doesn't want to be everything for everybody. Because if you're everything for everybody, many times there's nothing left for yourself. And so it took me a while to understand that. And through COVID, we had a lot of struggles at our family business. And I had to focus on my wellness so I could get other people through those terrible times. So I think a lot of, and doctors, my brother-in-law is an ER doctor. I asked them the other day, when was the last time you got a checkup? It's like, 20 years ago. It's like, doctors.
Always the doctors that don't get checked out.
Yeah, the doctors, the therapists, like the people that take care of us, I find are most likely to not be doing the simple things that we do. So if I can leave any message from this podcast is whatever you do, make sure you're taking care of yourself as well as everybody else. And that allows me to do some of these things for ALS, for our troops, you know, for Jewish friends. And that I think for me, but it took me 20 years to realize that.
Speaking of taking care of yourself and in our area, given how important your ears are and hearing is for your livelihood, what have you done over the span of your career to be mindful of your hearing and protecting it?
Yeah, and for sure. My wife was a music executive and spent 20 years in clubs, and she has, you know, she has a lot of issues with her hearing. Fortunately for me, I haven't had some of the degradation that many of my colleagues have. It's, you know, when you're on the road, typically rock bands on the road these days, you know, forever in the 70s and 80s, they just played with amps and cranked it up. Most people aren't in ears. So that, I think that helps in a certain way. I still like the sound of an amp before, you know, and the room. So I kind of have one in, one out, but being aware of stage volume and also taking care of, you know, getting tested, which I do every year. So I think, again, musicians have become much more conscious about the realities of problems in hearing through the years. So we're much more careful now. And especially my guys who play, you know, 300 shows a year in rock bands, drummers, for example, yeah. who are drummers. I think it's the hardest because you're hearing those.
Right. And the hi-hats,
those frequencies. But still, you know, I would have to say most of my musician pals, the rock guys, they struggle. They still struggle with it. And you know, as you know better than I do, it's like once you lose certain capacity, you don't get it back.
Yeah. Yeah. And these days with the in-ear monitors, we have a lot more flexibility than we used to try and kind of hear from the artists what their struggles are and why they don't like two in-ears yeah. in to yeah. try and work around that to create solutions that become manageable, but also serve the purpose of you getting access to the sound you need on stage.
100%.
Being on the road, we've asked a few musicians this kind of question. Do you prefer the large venues that have the lights, the sounds, all the excitement, or do you prefer a smaller, more intimate setting where a couple hundred people and it's not as many people that might be watching, but a closer connected audience?
The answer is yes. You know, what we have been doing the last few years is in the spring and the fall, I'll go out with my string quartet and do those very intimate shows, you know, smaller venues, kind of pin drop venues where you can tell stories. It's a very musical show. You can even interact with the audience, ask questions and talk with people in the audience. And I love doing that, especially with my string quartet. But then in the summer, we go out with the rock band and we play larger venues where you can't have that sense of intimacy, but you have a much more grander kind of performance. And, you know, I went out with the band called the Bare Naked Ladies a few summers ago, you know, and they have the fun show and they play for 5,000-10,000 people a night. And to go out and play for that audience is such a thrill. And to have that, you know, to have 10,000 people singing your song back to you, there's really not much better than that. So I love the fact that we can go back and forth. But if you said you could only do one, I would probably pick the more intimate venues because that's how I like to see my favorite artists. I love to see James Taylor with a guitar, you know, by himself. You know, I love to see Tori Amos at a piano. So if I had to pick one, I'd pick the kind of smaller venues. But believe me, we're pumped about this, you know, this tour that's coming this summer. And we have a band called Vertical Horizon that's opening for us, who was a band that was kind of my contemporaries. And it really does take you back to the future when you do those shows.
I saw them 25 years ago at Irving Plaza in the city.
That's it, man. Hey, I did my Irving Plaza.
I love that place.
Yeah. No, it's our first ever kind of New York real show was at Irving Plaza, you know, and it was a rock show. It was, you know, everybody standing up and
yep.
and I have to play Superman and people wanted to start moshing. I'm like, that's me.
So my last question for you that we've enjoyed asking of people on the podcast, we have the privilege of becoming a part of our patients' stories, that there are certain patients we really connect with. We help them bring back their hearing, whether it's cochlear implants, hearing aids, whatever it may be. Can you think of a time where you felt like you really got to become a part of somebody's story?
Well, we talked about Augie Nieto, right? Mm-hmm. I actually wrote a song called Augie Nieto. And Augie was so happy about that. He changed so many lives and he changed my life. And to this day, whenever I feel woe is me or, you know, that life's not fair, I think of Augie. And I'm actually playing, the bash is continuing. I'm playing another bash in October and the Augie's quest continues. So, you know, for me to kind of to know him and, you know, show up to be hired to play a song and then spend, you know, 15 years with him and his family fighting this battle. I'm so blessed to know. He wrote a book called Success to Significance. And I often think, you know, what I'm doing now, you know, these songs I'm doing now, they don't get any spins on the radio, no sales, but they're having a significance that maybe some of my hits did not. And so I attribute that to Augie and his, you know, his will and love of life and his humor. He used to have a list of the 10 best reasons to have ALS. And many of them were rated X, you know?
Okay.
You know, so it's like when you hang with a guy like that and gives you that kind of joy and sense of living, it carries on. So, and there's certainly been many others in my life, but Augie's always the first that comes to mind.
And it sounds like as much as you became a part of his story, he equally became a part of yours.
Isn't that the best stories?
Absolutely. My last question for you is there any theme that you have not yet explored within your music, any topic, anything you're passionate about that you haven't explored within music that you would like to at some point, that you'd like to write more about?
You know, I've always wanted to write a musical. I actually worked on a musical project for a year and a half, you know, 7-8 years ago. I grew up watching musicals, and they were a big part of my kind of musical formation. And it's a lot of work, and it's a lot of time, but I've had that in the back of my mind for a while, and I have a couple ideas. So if the world ever calms down a little bit and gives me a little time to do that, perhaps that will be my swan song. But you know, that's something that I think about.
Well, I'm a Broadway nerd, so I'm excited. I'm staying tuned.
Yeah, well, we need young Broadway fans, you know. We need to get some youth in there because it's struggling. So I'm glad you're— what's your favorite musical, Michelle?
Dear Evan Hansen.
Right on. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah, I love it. Yeah, Mr. Platt.
Yeah.
We've had quite a few Broadway sound people and actors on, so it's an area we've really tried to dive into as well here. So, John, why don't you let people know where they can connect with your music, with your touring, and the projects you have going on, whether charitable or professionally?
Well, thank you. All the info is at fightforfighting.com. You can even email me there. It says email John if you have a question or something. We are going out with Vertical Horizon in August, so all the dates are up there, and then we'll be out with the String Quartet again in October. Instagram is Fight for Fighting Music. Twitter is John Ondrasik. If you can spell it, good for you.
We'll link to it in the episode description.
Facebook, all the stuff, you know. But yeah, you know, I think again, I think folks that come to the shows, we always do a show that recognizes our troops. And I like to tell people too, all our shows are family shows. I know these days some people are a little nervous about bringing their kids, but as someone who did a lot of shows with little kids, my kids there, we respect that. So it's a show for everybody, and the kids and grandma and the uncles. You know, hopefully we'll see folks this summer.
Awesome. Well, we look forward to catching you out on the road, and thank you for using your voice and your music to impact and make a difference in the world. We are grateful.
Well, thank you guys for what you do every day and keeping our hearing intact. And again, we love and support everything you do as well. So it's a team effort.
Thanks so much.
All right, guys.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
All right.
Bettering your business takes working with the best. With the James Hardie Alliance, you gain access to leads, training, networking, and support from the number one brand of siding in North America. Achieve new levels of success by joining the James Hardie Alliance today.